You're up in the morning. Good afternoon, and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Gil Klein. I'm vice president of the club and a national correspondent for Media General newspapers, writing for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, the Tampa Tribune, and the Winston-Salem Journal. Yes. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you who are watching on C-SPAN or listening to this program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I would like to remind our members of some upcoming speakers. On Thursday, November 11th, Bobby Knight, Indiana University basketball coach, will discuss academic standards for athletes. That fits right in with today's program. On Tuesday, November 16th, Yitzhak Rabin, the Prime Minister of Israel, will talk about the peace in the Middle East. And on Wednesday, November 17th, the inventor of Barney, Cheryl Leach, will discuss kids and television, and Barney himself will make an appearance. Other upcoming luncheon speakers include violence against women expert Catherine McKinnon, the president of Harrah's Casinos, Phil Satre, U.S. Surgeon General Jocelyn Elders, FBI Director Louis Free, and TV producer Norman Lear. For the convenience of our audience, transcripts and audio and videotapes of this luncheon are available. The transcripts will be available for fax transmission within 2 hours. The transcripts or tapes may be ordered by calling 1-800-500-9911. And please note that's a new number from the one we used to give out here. If you have any questions for our speaker, please write them on the cards provided at your table and pass them up to me, and I will ask as many as time allows. I'd now like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly as their names are called. From your right, Peggy Roberson of the National Desk of Hearst Newspapers. Amy Schwartz, editorial writer for the Washington Post. Everett Fly, member of the board of the Federation of State Humanities Councils. Carl Pisano, news editor of Newsday. Kathy Kiley, Washington Bureau Chief of the Houston Post and a member of the Board of Governors of the National Press Club. Lucy Durr Hackney, the wife of today's speaker. Skipping over a speaker for a moment, we have Reginald Stewart, Assistant News Editor of Knight Ridder Newspapers and Chairman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee. Alicia Huerero, Professor at Prince George's Community College and member of the National Council of the Endowment for the Humanities. Cheryl Fields, Associate Managing Editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education and the member of the National Press Club Speakers Committee who arranged today's luncheon. Steve Goldstein of the Philadelphia Inquirer. And finally, Kenneth Eske, columnist for the Scripps Howard newspapers. Also, I'd like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Pat Thornsberry, and Melanie Abdal McDermott, and Jeff Tarbell for organizing today's luncheon. Our speaker today is Sheldon Hackney, the newly appointed chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Mr. Hackney comes at us at a time when the culture wars are still raging across America. For Mr. Hackney, who controls $180 million in federal grants for historical research, museum development, and other cultural institutions that preserve the record of human development, deciding how to interpret American history is more than an academic exercise. He can put his money where his mouth is. On his road to this position, Mr. Hackney became embroiled in a couple of the skirmishes of the Cultural War. Shortly before the end of his 12 years as president of the University of Pennsylvania, two incidents that should have been of minor importance were splashed all over the nation. One was when black students stole 14,000 copies of an independent student newspaper, the Daily Pennsylvanian, because they were angered by the paper's treatment of racial issues. The other was a fracas that arose when a white student shouted, "Shut up, you water buffaloes," to black students making noise outside his room. Suddenly, conservatives were lambasting Hackney for not standing up for the rights of free expression. He was labeled the Pope of political correctness. Perhaps I should address you as His Holiness. Mr. Hackney easily won confirmation, but the attacks left some scars. After spending a lifetime promoting free expression, he admitted to being hurt a little by the charges. A native of Birmingham, Alabama, Mr. Hackney was turned on to history by two high school teachers. He earned a bachelor's degree at Vanderbilt University and studied under the renowned Southern historian C. Van Woodward at Yale, where he earned his doctorate. He made a contribution to the study of Southern history as a professor at Princeton and soon moved to administration, first as Princeton's provost, then as president of Tulane University, and finally leading the University of Pennsylvania. But now that he's settled in at his desk at the National Endowment, he says he's putting all the controversy behind him. His primary message, he says, is the joy of knowledge. He wants to start a national conversation about what are America's core values. Who are we as a people? Do we have a single heritage or a multiple heritage? What is justice in a pluralistic society? Mr. Hackney, if you can begin to find answers to those questions, you will have done the nation a great service. So let the national conversation begin. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in a warm press club welcome for Mr. Sheldon Hackney.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that welcome very much, and the introduction, I must say, which was kinder than my other introductions to Washington. I had intended, of course, to slip into town unnoticed and to take up this new task at the National Endowment for the Humanities, but fate would not have it quite that way. But I am there now and enjoying it a lot. I am honored to be at the National Endowment for the Humanities. I think it is a good job for me. I remember being called soon after the president's intention to nominate me was announced by my brother from Birmingham, and he said what a thrilling thing it was, how terrific, a perfect job. Now, what does the NEH actually do? And I have been facing that question, but as I go around in my new capacity as the chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, the most troublesome question that I get, and the one that is most difficult to answer, is simply the question of what are the humanities and why do we need them? Let me say a word about that. What we think of ourselves, what we see as admirable behavior, what we think it means to be human, what we recognize as the human condition, what we learn from human experience and human thought, what we accept as the purpose of life, what we define as a just society, what we decide that we owe to each other, what we understand as how the world works, are not simply matters of idle curiosity, but fundamental determinants of our existence. The humanities, I think, matter. They are important to everyone. They are so important that the federal government needs to foster their development and ensure their broad availability. That, I believe, is the genius of the vision of Senator Claiborne Pell and Senator Jacob Javits and Senator Edward Kennedy and President Lyndon Johnson and other founders of the National Endowment for the Humanities in 1965. And it has been the inspiration, the nurturers of that vision in the succeeding 28 years. What we think determines what we do. And what we think, even what we think about the values that we hold dear, will be enormously improved if it is informed by knowledge and disciplined thought, by the study of history and philosophy and literature and religion. That is what Maya Angelou had in mind in her inaugural poem last January when she rephrased George Santayana. History, despite its wrenching pain, cannot be unlived, but if faced with courage, need not be lived again. The same theme was struck by President Clinton in his dedication of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in April. There, after enumerating some of the evil forces that are loose in the world that threaten civilization with brutality, just as the Nazis once did, the President exhorted us all to be vigilant against the falsifiers of history. With them, we must all compete for the interpretation and the preservation of history, of what we know and how we should behave. Well, I begin with these powerful sentiments because I believe that I am joining a very distinguished tradition at the NEH at a particularly critical juncture in the nation's history when the benefits of the humanities are especially important. Let me explain. Last week, Mark Shields, in his newspaper column, reminded us of the current cynicism of the American public, or more precisely, the lack of confidence that the public has in the national government to handle our domestic problems adequately. One can think of a lot of reasons for the public to be in an anxious mood these days, but as Mr. Shields points out, the decline in public confidence began more than two decades ago, sometime in the 1960s. My own understanding of this worrisome phenomenon is helped by realizing that it is not simply the national government that has slipped in the estimation of the American public, but public confidence in all American institutions has declined. I used, as a university president, to take a smidgen of perverse pleasure in the fact that universities ranked higher in the public's estimation than our chief tormentors, the Congress and the press. But the grim truth is that levels of confidence in institutions of American life rise and fall together. And the secular trend line for more than the last two decades has been down. Just before the election a week ago, Kevin Phillips wrote about voter hostility towards elites of all kinds, about popular opposition to NAFTA as being a matter of suspicious locals versus arrogant globals who are out of touch with mainstream America, and about ethnic and racial tensions throughout the country. The off-year elections confirmed this diagnosis of anger and volatility in the public mood. Why the cynicism? Why the insecurity? Why the alienation? The short answer is that the new geopolitical forces of the still evolving New World Order and the newly visible economic forces of the global marketplace are battering a society whose bonds of social cohesion have been loosening for a quarter of a century or more. This isn't really the place to try to explain in great detail the fundamental economic, demographic, and social forces that have an atomizing effect on society. But those forces are real, and they have been acting over a very long period of time. In addition, the basic confidence and optimism thought to be embedded in American national character were dealt a severe blow, or a series of severe blows in the early 1970s by the loss of the war in Vietnam, the disgrace of the presidency and the Watergate scandal, the economic shock of the Arab oil embargo, which was perhaps the first painful message that our economy was vulnerable to developments and decisions in the world economy in a way that we had no control over. Into this condition of attenuated solidarity, the politics of difference have introduced another lever of fragmentation. During the very turbulent decade of the 1960s, almost all the values and the verities of middle-class life were challenged by the counterculture, leaving the domain of values a contested territory. The cultural consensus of the 1950s, whatever one thinks of it, was destroyed in that process, and we have not yet fully developed a new consensus. In addition, the successful civil rights movement provided a paradigm for progress through protest. Movements on behalf other groups that had been excluded from full participation in American life, here I'm thinking of women, of gays and lesbians, the handicapped, Native Americans, Latinos, and to some extent Asian Americans, all those groups adopted the paradigm of progress through protest. Then the collapse of the Soviet system, while lifting our spirits in hopes for the spread of human freedom, has also unleashed pent-up ancient animosities. Around the globe, we see conflict and violence sowing misery along the fault lines of race, religion, language, and ethnicity, just the sorts of divisions being brought to our attention by the politics of difference and by the increasing cultural diversity of our population. as the insecurities of a rapidly changing world are alluring Americans and others around the world into clutching and reasserting their parochial identities, Americans must wonder if Bosnia and Azerbaijan are just previews of our own future. Several weeks ago, the New York Times published a feature article by William Grimes entitled, Have a Expletive Deleted Day, about the rising tide. If you want the exact quotation, it is pound sign, percentage sign, exclamation point, and sign, dollar sign, and exclamation point. There's some sort of speech code at the Times, I'm sure. This article, you're a little slow. This article, which I think is a fine article, is about the rising tide of incivility that seems to be engulfing the country. From Howard Stern to Beavis and Butthead, we are assaulted daily by countless acts of public rudeness. Among the cultural roots of this phenomenon, Mr. Grimes focuses on cultural diversity. New Yorkers have never been terribly civil, he quotes a professor of the humanities at Cooper Union as saying, but it never had an ideological edge, which it now has. Mr. Grimes goes on to quote the same professor approvingly in his critique of the new tribalism. If we have fundamentally different values and assumptions, there's no reason to believe we can transcend them in the political arena. Multiculturalism argues that persuasion is irrelevant. Well, small wonder that reasonable voices have lately been saying that we have been paying too much attention to our differences and not enough attention to the things that hold us together. From the other direction, however, we continue to hear assertions of what Charles Taylor, the philosopher, refers to as the politics of recognition, the notion that there are still disadvantaged groups in America whose members will never feel equal or really part of America until their group is recognized in some way as being legitimate and equal. There is truth in both of these positions. We find ourselves caught in a dilemma. All of our legal rights are universal in nature and apply equally to all citizens as individuals. Yet we know that racial, ethnic, gender, and religious discrimination exists, and that group identities are real factors in our lives. Ethnic politics has been a staple in the American political scene for more than 100 years and is still very much present in our system. The dilemma is that our legal rights are for individuals, but our politics are for groups. Now, that this is more than an academic argument is clear if one recalls the hand-to-hand combat of school board battles involving such issues as bilingual education or Afrocentric curricula, the dispute over the literary canon at the college level, or the court decisions seeking to remedy past patterns of discrimination in voting rights cases by requiring redistricting or changes in the form of local government so as to guarantee the minority community representation in the legislative body. In each of these cases, and others that you can probably think of yourselves, public authorities are being asked to confer some sort of official status on a particular cultural group. Large parts of the public sense that this form of particularism is a problem in a system based on universal values of individual rights. Simply saying that everyone must respect everyone else's ethnic identity, therefore, does not solve the problem. Yet, a solution must be found if we are to recapture a confident sense of shared values that will let us deal with divisive public policy issues with a common goal in mind. What is needed in our country is nothing short of a national conversation about this difficult and troubling dilemma. All of our people, left, right, and center, have a responsibility to examine and discuss what unites us as a country, about what we share as common American values in a nation comprised of so many divergent groups and beliefs. For too long, we have let that which divides us capture the headlines. Current public debate is little more than posturing. Bombarded by slogans and epithets, points and counterpoints, our thoughts are polarized in the rapid-fire exchange of sound bites. In this kind of argument, one is either right or wrong, for them or against them, a winner or a loser. Real answers are the casualties of such drive-by debates. In this kind of discussion, there is no room for complexity and ambiguity. There is no room in the middle. Only the opposite poles are given voice. That may be good entertainment, but it is a disservice to the American people. It only reinforces lines of division and does not build toward agreement. I want to change the rules of engagement for this national conversation. This is to be a national conversation open to all Americans, a conversation in which all voices need to be heard, and in which we must grapple seriously with the meaning of American pluralism. It is a conversation that is desperately needed, and I believe that the National Endowment for the Humanities can stimulate and facilitate that discussion. The NEH, of course, will not bring answers, but we will bring questions. To be sure, the NEH has other important tasks. As the single most important source of support for the humanities in American life, receiving approximately 9,000 applications a year and dispensing $150 million through about 2,000 grants, we have a major role to play in assisting in the creation of new knowledge, translating that knowledge in the humanities into educational experiences, both formal and informal, and in extending the reach of the humanities through programs that embrace many more Americans so that they may benefit from the transforming power in the humanities in their everyday lives. We will continue to support individual scholars, both in the academy and outside. We will continue to bring high school and college teachers together on university campuses for summer seminars that refresh and reinvigorate them. We will continue to support programs in museums and libraries and archives where our cultural heritage is preserved and used for public programs and made available for study. We will continue to fund excellent programs through the mass media, such as Ken Burns' documentary on the Civil War and Henry Hampton's series on the Great Depression. And we will work with renewed enthusiasm with state humanities councils to enlist more Americans in humanities activities, be it reading and discussion groups, or Chautauqua, or communities recording and telling their own story, connecting individuals and groups to the broader context of human experience so that they become the subjects of history rather than its objects. With some of our time and energy, however, and a little bit of our money, we will conduct a national conversation. I have been very pleased to discover that numerous programs sponsored by the state humanities councils have already started people talking to each other and with each other about who we are as a nation and what holds us together. The projects have taken many forms, small town residents and farmers gathering under Chautauqua tents in North Dakota or Wyoming, exploring American democracy and the ideas of Thomas Jefferson, citizens in Florida meeting to explore the search for the common good, Californians reading and discussing serious essays on the topic of longing for community, dream or nightmare, or hundreds of Iowans meeting to explore religious pluralism in a program called Faith in Politics, American Pluralism, Can We Live Together? I am encouraging the Federation of State Humanities Councils and the individual state councils to intensify their pursuit of this theme and to explore it in programs of their own devising. I will set aside a modest but significant amount of money for an endowment-wide initiative that can respond to competitive proposals from all around the country, from state councils, from libraries, museums, and archives, from schools and colleges and universities, from centers and institutes. I'm also delightfully aware that a number of scholars from various disciplines and many different points of view have been talking and writing about this subject of the national conversation for the last 3 or 4 years. The MacArthur Foundation has agreed to be an early partner in this enterprise by bringing together a group of these already engaged scholars to talk to each other. And out of that small discussion, and others that are already taking place at the local level, we will gain some insights into various aspects of this subject, into how to phrase the questions productively, into what sorts of materials stimulate the most fruitful discussions, and into the range of possible answers. I imagine that after some experience, we should be able to conduct this conversation through mass media formats. This really is an exciting undertaking for the NEH and for the country. Now, my own notion of the meaning of American pluralism is still evolving and in any case is certainly not prescriptive. Yet it might help if I sketch for you some of the elements of it here. My answer has as its preface a belief that there is an American identity that is different from the identities of any one of the ethnic groups that comprise the American population, that is inclusive of all of those particular identities, and that is available to everyone who is an American. It is an identity that has been shaped by the buffeting and melding of individuals and groups in North America over the last 300 years. I believe that the most important thing that we share as Americans is a belief in the political system, in the values that are enshrined in the Constitution, and in the open democratic system for determining who makes and who enforces the laws, and that laws should be consistent with those principles. Further, in this land of opportunity, we believe in equal economic opportunity for individuals. We know that we do not perfectly provide equal opportunity, but it is an ideal that we hold dear, and we have historically provided enough opportunity to keep individual hope alive and to maintain faith in the ideal. We also have a history that belongs to all Americans, whenever their ancestors happen to have migrated to these shores. That history is a proud one, but it has some dark spots, and we must come to terms with those imperfections as well as the glories. I am, for instance, a white Southern male, but I claim as part of my own story the experiences of Italians and Irish and Jews coming into America through Ellis Island in the late 19th and early 20th century, and the experience of African Americans who lived in the South with my ancestors and saw it from a very different point of view. Or more recently, the experience of South Asians and Latinos coming into a more mature country. My story should be theirs as well, and we all possess together the national story, the resultant of many different vectors, the story of our being able to find solutions, to rise to historical challenges, and find ways to transform particular interests into the national interest. Beyond these individual building blocks, there are a few precepts that might help us as we go through the discussion about what it means to be American. The traditional way of handling cultural differences has been to think about a public sphere and a private sphere. In the public sphere, only universalistic rules are legitimate, and only individual rights are legally protected. In the private sphere, we can give voice and form to our birthright identities without being any less American. This distinction still goes a long way in sorting out the conflicts between the universal and the particular. Indeed, if there is no distinction between the public and the private, all values would be up for political adjudication, and that is not a system that I find very attractive. One of the factors causing the current sense of urgency about this subject is the feeling that the public or political sphere has been encroaching on the private sphere. Let your culture be your politics, the cultural radicals of the 1960s chanted. All politics are personal, and all personal relationships are political, assert some contemporary activists. Where in all of this are the ordinary virtues that we ought to be able to expect from each other? Perhaps they can emerge from the big conversation. It also helps to realize that all ethnic groups have permeable boundaries, and that the meaning of any particular identity will change over time. What it felt like to be a white Southerner in 1865 is different from what it felt like in 1950, and it is different still again today. What it means to be a Jew in America is different today from what it was in 1940. History has a way of changing who we think we are. This subject is elusive, but it is very important. If the conversation works well, we will stake out some common ground, and by doing that, we will make it possible to celebrate more fully the variations among us that play against each other and reinforce each other to produce a dynamic national identity. As President Clinton said in a different context at the dedication of the Holocaust Memorial Museum, we must find in our diversity our common humanity. We must reaffirm that common humanity even in the darkest and deepest of our own disagreements. In that spirit, I am looking forward to this conversation among the American people. In that spirit, I challenge you in the press to help focus the attention of the American people on this quest for the meaning of E Pluribus Unum. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hackney. We've got quite a few questions, but I certainly invite you to think up some real tough ones and send them up here. First question is,
yeah, well, don't worry.
I thought we'd use that.
We could get into Southern agrarian reform in the 1890s if we want to use up another 2 minutes here. Now, the first question was, would you characterize the Perot-Gore meeting of last night as a drive-by debate, a monument to incivility, or both? Does this sort of show hurt the, quote, national conversation of which you speak?
I was out last night, did get a chance to watch, so the only thing I know, is what I read in the papers, and I'm not sure that's an adequate basis on which to pass judgment.
Anybody see that fastball go by here? Okay. Next question. Your predecessor, Lynn Cheney, in her last presentation here, delivered a report that lambasted universities for being narrow in their approach, that they had been taken over by a liberal thought police who were not allowing a wide range of debate and scholarly research in departments, especially like history. Do you agree with her, or where do you come down on that?
Well, I worked for 12 years to try to get control of the debate at Penn and never succeeded. So I actually, more seriously, I think that free speech is alive and well on college campuses across the country. This is a debate about what the reality is, not about what the values should be. I think I hope that we all agree that academic freedom is precious to us as a nation and to the health of universities. That freedom is still being protected on college campuses. There are always pending threats to that, and I would agree that there are worrisome intellectual forces that might threaten some of the intellectual progress and perhaps even some of the free speech on college campuses. I do not think they are in control. I hope they will never become in control. So I will watch the scene from Washington to see what happens in the future. I did my bit while I was there.
The historian Arthur Schlesinger wrote that Afrocentric education is actually a detrimental force moving the country toward political apartheid. Do you agree? What do you come down on Afrocentric education? Is that something that you would like to promote or not?
Arthur Schlesinger Jr. is one of those reasonable voices that I had in mind in the talk. He is worried that we have placed too much emphasis on differences and not enough on our similarities and what we share, and in that I do agree with him. Afrocentric education means so many different things to different people that I think it's not very useful to try to respond in general. Educationally, it does make a lot of sense to try to reach people educationally in what through a subject that they respond to automatically. I became a Southern historian, I look back and now realize, because I was interested in finding out who I was. I think that is something that we all share, especially in the late teenage years as we're coming to maturity, when we're having our identity crisis and trying to define who we are as individuals and what sort of person we want to be. We need to know more about who we are and where we come from. It is natural to try to want to explore those roots. So in that sense of Afrocentrism, I think it is quite useful. But there may be other senses in which I would not agree that it's a good thing to base a curriculum around.
This question we'd like to know is, would you consider withholding NEH grants to any institution that does not unequivocally support free speech issues? For example, that is slow to condemn the trashing of controversial student newspapers.
I think the criteria for NEH grants should be the quality of the grant itself and what it promises to do for the American people. I don't think any sort of muzzling is in order.
How do you think the nation's public institutions, cultural, educational, civic, should deal with the rise in America's Hispanic population? Where do you come down on the debate over bilingual education?
I am not an expert in bilingual education, so I really can't comment fruitfully. I mentioned it in my talk because it is an example of a debate that has been raging and that is being fought out basically not on the evidence about the educational effect or wisdom of using bilingual education in order to reach children and educate them, but on the notion of what is American. It is a great example of how we need to have the discussion first about what it means to be American before subjects like bilingual education can really be faced on their merits.
Do you really expect the national conversation to engage the American people? And how will you reach the people in Peoria?
That's a question that I take to have really two different parts, or at least in my mind, there's a format question or a matter of how do we reach people actually, physically? How do we get them together to talk about this? And maybe a prior question about what are people going to be interested? I have talked to a lot of small groups. I've talked to a group of congressmen about 2 weeks ago. I've talked to a group of foundation heads. I've talked to members of Jamil Zinnelden's Federation of State Humanities Councils about this. I've talked to a number of other groups. And simply mentioning the need for this national conversation, their conversation takes off and I'm left behind. They want to talk about the substance of this. So I think there is no, if the question is phrased properly and if the surroundings are appropriate, I think it is a conversation that the American people are dying to have. The question about how, this is a nation of 250, 260 million people, how do you engage them all? Well, clearly we can't do that all at the same time. My own notion is that the subject is sufficiently volatile so that we want to make sure that we know how to phrase it productively, how to get the kind of conversation going that we want to have going, a serious conversation in which ideas are exchanged and people's positions are at least available for changing during the conversation. So I think face-to-face meetings at the local level throughout the country are a good way to begin. We will learn from those meetings and then we can take what we learned there about how the discussion goes to perhaps have electronic town meetings or have a panel program like the old Fred Friendly programs in which a panel of people responds to an interlocutor who is well versed in the subject and presses them about what they mean in their position on what it means to be an American. There are ways to do that through mass media, but I would think that the mass media would be not the first step, but perhaps the second or the third step.
I have a son in the fifth grade, and I have seen what has happened to American history education, at least in the elementary school level, that it's been watered down, that it's, that they, in studying Virginia history, they got all the way up to maybe the American Revolution before the year ended, because they had so many things they had to cover that were not there when I was there. Do you see a need to overhaul historical education in the elementary and secondary levels?
It would be a blessing. This is something on which I have opinions that have nothing to do with the NEH. I'll give you my prejudices. We do have a problem in the teaching of history in this country, and I believe it does need some attention because I believe history is one of the disciplines that gives one a sense of place and time and who one is, and it is not simply one damn thing after another. It is best told as and taught as a story. It is gripping and riveting and automatically interesting, and we can place ourselves in it and relate to it. And it shouldn't be a list of names and dates and battles and elections. There are problems also in history, and I think as students get older and more sophisticated, they get much more interested in the why questions of history and using the why questions. Why did the Civil War occur? Why indeed did the South lose, or why did the North win? The North, see, the Union. those are really interesting questions, and you need to know something before you can answer them. And if you tease the student with the question and get them interested in the question, then they want to go learn what they need to know in order to answer the question. That's I think maybe the best approach. Now, there is one thing that the NEH is doing that is in this area, and that is working with scholars across the country and with various historical organizations to create some national standards for history for the schools. And this would be is part of the Goals 2000 effort. I think it is a tricky thing to devise national standards, but we are doing it in a very collegial way, and I think a consensus has developed on the American history standards, and that's something I'm very pleased about. Secretary Riley is very enthusiastic about such standards, not only in history but in other fields, and the NEH is cooperating by leading the effort to provide or establish standards in several fields, including history and a few others.
You had said it in an interview following up on this that it was there you had two history teachers who in high school who really turned you on to this, and that they were just using the old roll-down maps. What was it in their teaching method that connected with you?
That is a good question, because all they had was a chalkboard and these old, musty, oily roll-down maps. I found the maps fascinating for some reason, but they taught history as an interesting story, and they were also quite demanding. They were known as very tough teachers, so there was a bit of a challenge to see how well one can do in their classes, but they also clearly cared about their subject. They were enthusiastic about it, and they conveyed that enthusiasm for the subject to their students. Being in their class was fun, it was challenging, it was interesting, never boring. You could never go to sleep there, because they were always about to call on you to ask you what you knew. All those teaching techniques they had, these are old-fashioned teaching techniques, they were very good at those.
Why is it so hard for the American people and Congress to understand what the humanities are? What can be done to promote understanding of the importance of humanities in American life?
I've just tried to do some of that. but it is an interesting question. You notice that when the Congress authorized or created the endowments in 1965, they wrestled with the question of what the humanities are, how you define them. And they settled not for trying to define the humanities, but simply listing the disciplines. And in every authorization since that time, you will find not a definition of the humanities, but a list of disciplines that are included. And it's not an inclusive list. It is a suggestive list of the humanities. And there are other things that you can study that aren't listed that have humanities content, science. There is a way to do science that has humanistic content. It is a very difficult subject. I was part of the Rockefeller Commission on the Humanities in the 1979-80, and we spent distinguished people sitting around a table talking about the humanities and gathering data. We spent fully 6 months of that one-year project arguing about how to define the humanities, and I came away thinking that it really wasn't very productive to try to do that, so I've tried to avoid it. I do have a shorthand definition of my own that I use in my own thinking, which is that the humanities are those things that cause people to think about the big questions: who they are as humans, where their place in the world is, what the purpose of life is, all those big questions, what the human condition is, and so on. You can do that through literature, you can do that through the study of history, you can do that through the study of philosophy, and the study of a lot of other things, but that basically is what it is.
Just recently, in the past couple of years, we had the 500th anniversary of Columbus, we had Jefferson's 250th birthday, I believe. In both cases, these both men were kind of redefined, not necessarily positively. Do you think that this trend is going too far, that we're trashing our old heroes too much? Is there not some value to keeping national icons?
Yes, but I agree that there is some value in having heroes, but one can't fence in the truth. You really have to pursue it. If unpleasant facts are discovered about someone that we take to be a hero, then one simply can't suppress them. You have to build it into an interpretation of their character. And one hopes that there is a judgment about historical figures that is rounded and considered and appropriate. That is a subject for discussion. In the case of the quincentennial of the discovery of America, which became very controversial, I thought that was a bit of a shame that we did not have a chance to understand, to study again, to revisit, and to celebrate the history of this hemisphere because it became so controversial. Actually, that is one of the things that I had in mind when thinking about the need for this national conversation about who we are. Had we more shared values, or that is, had we a deeper shared understanding of what American pluralism is, I think we would not have gone through pretty divisive discussion about how to celebrate the quincentennial, because we would have a shared sense of what is appropriate and how different parts of the population fit into that celebration.
This questioner wants to know, how much money will the eight national endowments spend to fund the National Conversation Program? Will you be asking the administration and Congress to fund it with additional appropriations?
No, will not be asking for more money. I will be asking for more money all the time, but not for this. This will come out of funds that now exist in the public programs. We're still arm wrestling a bit about how much it should be, but it will be a big six-figure number in the public programs area, and I am looking forward to that. It should be enough to make possible activities at the local level that are significant. But should not be so large as to distort our program effort in general, because that program effort is so important in its own right that I don't want to do that.
This questioner wants to know, do you think there's a revitalization of religion going on in America? If religion, like humanities in your definition, also makes people think about the big issues, is there a place for it in this national conversation? And is there a place for teaching about history, religion in a historical context?
Absolutely. My own sense that there is an increase in the interest of Americans in religion. I saw that on the university campus at the University of Pennsylvania. More students were more active in religious organizations. And I'm thinking here not simply of the rise of the religious right, which is a political phenomenon, but in a more broad spread resurgence of interest in the spiritual aspects of life in general. There certainly the study of religion is a humanities discipline, and I would think that it has a firm place right in the middle of this national conversation and in everything that the humanities do and what the NEH does. Legitimate subject.
What would you say to conservatives who have said they will be watching your performance at NEH for evidence that's of your liberal political bias?
I take my position to be a position of public trust. I am responsible for the funds that are appropriated by the Congress and made available by the President. I expect some scrutiny. I would hope that it is fair. I am quite willing to be judged by what the NEH does when I am the chairman, while I am the chairman. I am looking forward to that. So I don't take that as a dire threat at all, as long as it's a fair scrutiny.
This questioner begins with an assertion which I do not know whether it's true or not. It appears President Clinton is more interested in the arts and humanities than any president in recent history. What collaboration or support do you and the other endowments have with the administration?
I'll leave aside the introductory clause and say that the President and the First Lady are interested in the arts and the humanities. They made this very evident in October when they declared October to be National Arts and Humanities Month, or as we like to say at the NEH, National Humanities and Arts Month. And they had a wonderful ceremony on the South Lawn of the White House at which the National Medals of Art were awarded and the Frankel Prizes in the Humanities were awarded by the president. And there was a gala dinner that night, the first formal dinner in the White House since last January, which I think indicates very clearly how important the First Family thinks the arts and the humanities are for America. They happen to be busy people. I would like to get them more involved in the activities that we are stirring up here in Washington and around the country, but we will be asking for their help, and we have been assured that we will get it.
This questioner asked, could you say something about the National Endowment of the Humanities and the National Science Foundation collaboration?
I have some colleagues who are here who might be able to speak to that more generally. We have an interesting collaboration with the National Science Foundation, which both agencies are putting up some of their money to promote the study of the sciences. In our case, it's the sciences with something of a humanistic bent, because the science is at the base of our high-tech civilization now, high-tech economy certainly, and of our lives. So we want to understand how science is done, how it affects our lives. So it is a very useful cooperation, and some evidence that there are ways in which the NEH can multiply the effects of its very slender tax dollars that are appropriated to have a bigger impact on the American public than it would otherwise by cooperating with other federal agencies and with foundations and with other private organizations outside of government. So I'm very pleased with the NSF collaboration, and we will be continuing that.
A real parochial issue. I understand that you are working on a major program to preserve newspapers in the United States, something that we preserve. We certainly appreciate, yes, because we don't like them all being thrown away as fish wrapper the next day. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing and why is there a need to preserve newspapers?
After the late 19th century, newspapers were printed on acid paper. They are extraordinarily brittle. In the research that I did on Alabama in the late 19th century, I used newspapers that were really falling apart in my hands as I turned over the pages. We are losing the national patrimony, the national heritage, if you will, in information about American history, both in the newspapers and in brittle books. We have large projects going in both areas that involve microfilming, books and newspapers, two separate projects, actually, to try to preserve them. The digital world is coming, and we now have some projects going that are exploring digital technology to see what it can contribute to the preservation effort. There is a national plan now that is being followed by the NEH and by other by major libraries and organizations to make sure that we preserve the right books as we preserve books that need preserving. The newspaper project has been going on for longer, George, and 46 states are participating in the newspaper project. And all of the colonial imprints are on microfilm and microfiche. The focus is on 19th century papers, if you did not hear that. But it's a wonderful way in which the NEH can contribute in an invisible way. I mean, nobody ever knows about this, but if we are not active in this area, then the books and the newspapers and other documents that are in our archives and libraries and museums will not be there in 10 years or 20 years or 30 years for use by the public and for use by scholars. So it's very important.
Before asking the last question, I would like to present you with this certificate of appreciation for appearing here. And, of course, a National Press Club mug, which I'm sure you will like to put in the family archives.
I will indeed.
And the last question is, which is doing more to undermine American civilization, Beavis and Butthead or The Simpsons?
That's a hard choice. I think the Beavis and Butthead and the Simpsons are symptomatic of something that we were actually talking about a bit here at dinner. That is, we are living in a communications environment in which has had effects that we can recognize and a lot of effects that we have not yet defined. We are wired for instantaneous communication all across the country. That is so much so that the thirst for analysis and for the exchange of repartee is degraded a bit, or so rapid. So I tend to look at Beavis and Butthead not as a cause but as a symptom, and we're trying to get at the cause here through the national conversation.
Thank you very much. Just before we close, I'd like to remind you that transcripts now are available along with tapes, audio and video, at the National Press Club Library or by calling 1-800-500-9911. And Mr. Hackney, thank you very much for being here. I appreciate it.